Chapter 27. Just War. There are lots of ways to describe Sangin in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, and ground branch operators describe it in their own ways. The heart of darkness, the bad place, the Taliban's heartland, the sordid matrix of opium poppy production. And then there's this, pure evil. In official Pentagon parlance, Secretary of Defense Robert M. Gates said of Sangin, "This district is one of the most dangerous, not just in Afghanistan, but maybe in the whole world." Over a 10-year period, more American Marines and British soldiers would be killed in Sangin than in any of Afghanistan's 400 other districts. Now, the ground branch team from Gecko Base was heading here, its 12-vehicle convoy lumbering along the ambush-prone road. Shark, driving, focused on the taillights on the vehicle in front of him. They'd been painted over with black and covered in tape, so operators weren't blinded by the night vision devices they wore. There was a decent outline of the truck ahead, and at the same time, the convoy was hidden from people officials call Taliban or anti-coalition militia. Ground branch guys knew them simply as bad guys with guns. "It was a perfect night as far as light conditions were concerned," remembers Shark. "Enough moon and stars out that night that the night vision was perfect, and through those devices, I looked as far as I could see down Highway 1. To Shark, the road looked like it never ended, and it looked a bit eerie, too. The compounds that were in eyeshot were scattered around and had only smoke coming from within them, very little light. Some small fires were visible. The night was over for them, the villagers who lived there. They had eaten and were getting ready to sleep, most of them were. If it wasn't war, this night might have been a beautiful thing, and for a moment, a very brief, very dangerous moment, Shark thought of his own children back home. For a split second, I wondered if my kids were safe," he says. Then, instinctively, he shut that thought down. In the combat zone, behind enemy lines, "You never think of anything that makes you vulnerable," he says. "It interrupts the forward momentum that's been ingrained in you through training. This is a momentum you must maintain every second of every mission, no matter what." Suddenly, there were flashlights going off. Flashlights? Afghans signaling to one another from just outside their homes. This was optical telegraphing. Shark's first thought? Safe the snake. The enemy had been informed. Technically, this was a killer capture mission, 4 high-value targets, a bombmaker and his 3 lieutenants. But when someone knows you're coming, capture is off the table. The mission becomes kill or be killed. Having safe the snake on any mission was very much like putting together a ticking time bomb and bringing it along with you for the ride, says Shark. Driving 87 miles from Gecko Base to Sangin seemed to take forever, every curve in the road presenting some fresh danger. 30 minutes outside the target, the convoy came to a halt. There was a guard tower problem. A guard tower problem? An old Soviet-era guard tower that never had anyone in it now suddenly had someone in it. Calm said something about the Afghan National Police. "Every minute you're sitting still on an operation is a very bad minute," says Drew Dwyer. "Sitting ducks is the term," says Hawk. Shark adds context. "We had Spooky, the AC-130 gunship, overhead, and that takes away a lot of concerns, but it doesn't eliminate them altogether." Finally, the team was cleared to move on to the target. 5 minutes out, the pilot broke radio silence to announce that the target area was active, that he could see at least 10 personnel in the compound next to a mosque. The convoy moved the final 100 meters to the target. It was wet, cold, and muddy. The makeshift road was saturated and sloppy, remember Shark. The steering wheel felt loose, like there was no traction. His thoughts were interrupted by a whoosh sound streaking right by him, so close it felt like inches, so loud it sounded like the volume had been turned up. He watched an RPG-7, a rocket-propelled grenade, blast down the halted line of Ground Branch trucks. Then, whoosh, a second rocket fired by the convoy, somehow missing them on a second try. The Taliban didn't have night vision, and shooting in the dark means shooting blind. It was one of the advantages a Ground Branch team has, that and spooky tactical air support. The rocket detonated behind the convoy in an empty space that was supposed to be the entry point into the target area. "We exited the vehicles," recalls Shark. "Get out of the death box and take cover. Return fire. A volley of fire. Kill or be killed. There's always a firefight when you're Ground Branch." Then, as fast as the ambush started, the shooters were gone. The Taliban were masters of irregular warfare. They knew surprise, kill, vanish, like the back of their own hand. In the winter of 2008, Afghanistan had been at war for 29 consecutive years. First, with the Russian invaders starting in 1979, then with themselves after the invaders left from 1989 until 2001, and now with a coalition of American-led invaders, but invaders nonetheless. The voice of the pilot flying the AC-130 Spectre overhead came over the comms. "Three in a ditch, heading toward your location," the pilot said. "Calm, steady." "Ditch? What ditch?" The opium poppy growing land here in Sangin was zippered with irrigation canals, some filled with water, others with ice. "Another update. Be advised, you have 8 on foot behind you." Then came the distinct whoomp sound through Shark's noise-reducing comms, a ripping sound as the gunship fired down on the enemy from overhead. Spooky laying waste to whatever threatens your position in a variety of calibers, said Axe. The AC-130 Spectre gunship, Spooky, is a heavily armed, side-firing aircraft. With its sophisticated network of sensors and navigation and fire control systems, the gunship provides close air support at night in adverse weather and can loiter in an overhead circle for extended periods of time. The suite of sensors on board allows Spectre pilots to visually discern friendlies from enemies and to attack two targets simultaneously from above. There's little moral outrage over Spooky. It's a war machine used by the Defense Department in keeping with the laws of war and the rules of engagement. The pilot repeated, 8 on foot behind you, 3 in the ditch, and began firing. In a matter of seconds, all 11 humans were dead. Then silence. No more shooting. The compound was straight ahead. The pathway to the target was heavily wooded. Shark walked along. He had 8 Afghan soldiers with him, following along in a line. After a few minutes of walking, the area erupted in gunfire once again. After the shooting stopped, Shark continued to move forward to the target, his gun trained ahead. The mission was to locate the bomb maker and his lieutenants. The 11 dead were almost certainly foot soldiers, which means that the 4 high-value targets were probably hiding somewhere right around here. The compound needed to be cleared. There was work to do. Shark readied to make entry over the compound wall when suddenly it occurred to him that he was alone. Where had the Afghan Indige gone? Alone? How is this possible? Alone is dangerous. 2 rules. Never get in the trunk and never try to clear a room alone. But he was here. There was work to do. They'd come all the way to Sangin. Against his better judgment, Shark decided to go at it alone. He walked across the roof of the compound. He looked down into a hole like a stairwell minus the stairs. There was a wooden ladder leading down inside. It came to me that a flamethrower would have been nice, recalls Shark. I could have cleared the whole room with the flamethrower. But Protocol 3 of the Convention on Prohibitions or Restrictions of the Use of Certain Conventional Weapons prohibited soldiers from using incendiary weapons, which made little sense if you had just seen what Spooky did to the 11 men. They used flamethrowers in every other war, so why not here? Shark wondered. He headed back to the trucks to locate the rest of the team. At the convoy, he found that the Afghan soldiers were sitting around, some of them inside a vehicle. There was more work to be done, Shark said, including the SSE, or Sensitive Site Exploitation, of the compound, a search for materials, paper intelligence, bad guys' cell phones. There were two or three vehicles parked behind the compound that needed to be searched as well. Half the team needed to stay with the sensitive equipment in the trucks. The other half needed to go with him. Back at the target, a perimeter was set up and the compound was cleared, then searched. The HVTs had long gone. The SSE took 4 hours. Spooky kept watch overhead. Then it was time to go. Back at the trucks, there was an unbelievable commotion underway. A brand new truck, borrowed from the Rangers, was upside down in a hole. Sabotage? Had one or more of the Afghan Indige tried driving the truck away? The only thing more dangerous than lingering on infiltration was lingering on Exville. Time to get out of Sangin. But first, the sensitive communications gear in the vehicle needed to be destroyed. Destroy the entire vehicle, that would do the job. Ground branch operators poured 3 jerry cans of diesel fuel over the truck, tossed a thermite grenade inside, and watched it burn. The operators piled in the trucks, and the 11-vehicle convoy inched home across the same dark landscape. The Indige fighters, whose truck had mysteriously been turned upside down, squeezed in beside the ground branch team. In each vehicle, a computer screen displayed the bird's-eye view of the journey back home to Gecko Base, one layer of the GIS created in the basement of Langley by Ken Stiles and his team 6 years before. The metadata in the GIS had since been increased by orders of magnitude. Layers of anthropology and geography had been fused with every form of intelligence available. But was there any progress being made here in Afghanistan? Any at all? Could America ever win this war? Or was the whole effort, like the upside-down truck in Sangin, expensive, intractable, waiting to be burned to the ground? After the team got back to Gecko Base, all the data gathered in Sangin was inputted into the system, including photos from cell phones recovered, papers found in the compound, pocket litter from dead Taliban. All this information would be used to provide targeters working at a classified CIA facility in Kabul called Eagle Base with more information about whom to target and kill next. We were producing intelligence, and we were also a consumer of the intelligence we were producing, Hank Crumpton said of the original intent of covert action in Afghanistan. Now, 6 years later, all across Afghanistan, ground branch teams were still doing the same thing. But the goal, to become more productive, had arguably not been met. The situation in Afghanistan had gotten a lot worse. After all the SSE data from the Taliban compound in Sangin got turned over to the CIA chief of Gecko Base, the debrief took place. Shark brought up his idea about the flamethrower. I explained my reasons for it. It was valid in my eyes, beyond valid, and some of the guys loved it, but not everybody, he recalls. The boss rolled his eyes and said, "Let's discuss this offline." It wasn't received well, and I still don't understand why. We drop bombs on bad guys, fire cannons from the sky, which sets people on fire. Why is a flamethrower so taboo? Only a few of the guys made it to the post-mission fire pit discussion that night. We just sat there on the homemade wooden benches and pieced together the night. The issue of Saif Mohammed came up, and why wouldn't he? It wasn't a normal situation, says Shark. Having him on a mission felt like inviting suicide. Now, with the mission to Sangin over, the issue about killing Saif the Snake was back on the table. Let's get rid of him, one of the operators said. Shark suggested they throw him out of a helicopter. That would fix the problem, he said. Several of the ground branch guys agreed. They were almost at a consensus now. Almost. I told the chief what we thought should be done. Take him up on a helicopter, tell him it was a mission, then throw him out when we were up there, remember Shark. Problem solved. Shark says the chief of base was horrified. You can't do that, he said. The chief of base pulled me aside, recalls Shark. He asked me if I wanted to talk to a doctor, said maybe something was wrong with my head. I didn't appreciate that. Shark headed back to his sleeping quarters at Gecko Base, the second-story cargo container inside of which he lived. I grabbed my Copenhagen tobacco and my satellite phone. I had one call to make. The kids would be getting ready to go to bed soon. It was early morning for us. When I found that right spot to call home, a spot where my phone could access the satellites and get a call out, it all seemed very normal to me, he recalls. Hello? It was the voice of his ex-wife, whom he still loved, even after their divorce. He always experienced pain and difficulty talking to her. She was an excellent mother, and their children always did whatever it was she instructed them to do. They couldn't make their marriage work, he had to accept that. They both loved their children more than anything in this world. Let him say everything first, Shark's ex-wife said to the children back there in the United States. They always started their first volley of conversation with, Hi, Daddy, Shark recalls. Their soft, safe voices with a unique twang added, depending on what stage of baby teeth coming in or out they were in. Many of the times I would be on the receiving end of the sat phone for an extended period of time, just listening as they told me everything about the day. This time, like many times, Shark stared down at his own physical body. His boots were covered in someone else's blood. 6 days passed. I was standing in front of my metal fortress sleeping area, speaking with a medic, when I heard a call over the base radios, remember Shark. Come to the operation center, there's something to see, Stingray said. He insisted it was important. Inside the team room, one of the guys was grappling with some cables and a huge flat-screen TV that was attached to a concrete wall. After a few adjustments, the TV screen came to life. Whatever the operators were here to watch, it was from the point of view of a predator drone. You could see the desert floor through a window of superimposed white crosshairs. A structure came into view. The predator was hovering high in the sky, directly over a building in Sangin. There was tension in the air. Someone offered an explanation. The four Taliban they'd pursued 6 days before, the bombmaker and his three lieutenants, had been identified as presently being inside the compound they were now observing through the predator's viewfinder. The room was quiet. The image played without any sound. Everyone sat there enthralled. A few seconds passed. The screen went dark for a brief moment. When an image came back into view, there was a small cloud of smoke. Debris, ash, and fire blanketed the desert floor below. The cloud held strong for a few seconds until it became clear that all that was left of the compound was a rubble pile. The focus in the room was intense. Someone said, "Fuck yeah." Someone else said, "Unfucking believable." For as dramatic as it was, recalls Shark, we knew not to celebrate too loud or too often. It takes away from your readiness. That is what we are taught. Everyone stood up and started to leave. Then someone said, "Hey, look at that shit." Focus went back to the TV screen. Out from beneath the pile of rubble, a human being emerged, stumbling, wounded, alive. One of the four high-value targets, the bomb maker or one of his three lieutenants, had survived the drone strike. As the man stood there on the ground, bending over, gathering his senses, the numbers at the bottom center of the Predator's viewfinder began to move. "Here we go again," thought Shark. He was right. The screen went black for a moment. Then the rubble pile came back into view. This time, there was no movement on the ground. The fourth high-value target was dead. There were a few high fives in the room, and then the atmosphere returned to normal. "We went back to what we were doing," remembers Shark. Something had to be done about Save the Snake. "In Afghanistan," says Lightning, "you have to be willing to take the long route to an objective and a victory, because the fighters there, the Taliban and the other bad guys with guns, they're unlike anyone else you've ever gone up against before." The ground branch operators had been forbidden to kill Save the Snake. "So we came up with the next best idea, and that was to shame him," says Shark. "Make him lose his stature on the base." To orchestrate his fall from grace, the ground branch operators organized a friendly, or not-so-friendly, regulation boxing match. A bloodless, hidden-hand coup d'etat. There would be rules that had to be followed. A boxing ring was built. Regulation headgear and boxing gloves were brought in from the United States. The fighters were drawn randomly from a container of names in a box, says Shark. No funny business allowed. Except the funny business we factored in, so a certain Saif Mohammed would be fighting the biggest man on base. The carefully chosen opponent was the ground branch team's Afghan mechanic, a 210-pound heavyweight with teeth so strange he'd been given the nickname Jaws. By luck of the draw, the referee announced over the megaphone, "The fight is between Saif Mohammed and the mechanic." Saif the Snake stepped out of the crowd of soldiers and walked into the sandpit, where two American referees waited. Saif wore a strained smile on his puffy face. He had a full beard, and it was well kept, recalls Shark. He was shorter than most of the other Afghan soldiers, and it looked like he hadn't been missing any meals. He wore desert camouflage trousers and a large white t-shirt. Jaws, the mechanic, lumbered into the ring. He was big and slow, like a high school football player who hadn't yet grown into his oversized body, and he was a head taller than his opponent. The referees gave the fighters instructions translated through an interpreter. The fight began. Out in the stands, the spectators went wild. "A giddy crowd of soldiers who'd never seen a boxing match before," says Shark. The local day workers on base stopped working and were scattered around in the background, leaning on shovels or squatting down. The mechanic moved steadily into the center of the ring. Saif the Snake froze. The mechanic moved forward until they were face to face. It appeared each man was having second thoughts about the competition. The spectators went quiet. The bodies of the two fighters went tight, each as if he'd come upon a predator that required total stillness to get out alive, recalls Shark. Then Jaws hurled himself toward his frozen opponent, swinging at Saif with his 16-ounce regulation gloves. Saif put up his hands, but the blows came hard and fast. One of the lobs struck him in the side of his head, protected by light headgear. The audience went wild with excitement. There were cheers and boos at the same time. The mechanic moved his arms, working hard to generate solid punches. Mixed in the fighting was a sloppy combination of slaps and punches, but they were all flying in Saif's direction. He had not moved his gloves from the guard position. He stood there stunned and defenseless in front of the jeering crowd. His stature at the camp was being denigrated by the minute, recalls Shark. Break, round two. The mechanic raced in and unleashed a barrage of punches. Several went straight into Safe's gut. When Safe reached down to hold his stomach, the mechanic saw the opening and hurled a volley of punches his way. Safe stumbled, tripped, and hit the sand. Jaws leapt on him, smothering him and making strange jerking movements like someone was using a shock collar on him. The mechanic engulfed Safe. He was hardly visible anymore. There were several more punches thrown, hard blows to the gut and chest. As Saif Mohammed lay there looking straight up at the sky, Jaws mounted him and began pummeling him as if he had some training. The mechanic leaned in and began wailing on him over and over. This was obviously not a regulation move, and the referees moved in. Break, round three. The Ground Branch team had advertised a three-round fight and the winner receiving a $10 prize. Toward the end, the fighters were getting tired. Interest was fading. The Afghan soldiers needed a nap, says Shark, and they probably needed to hit the hookah again, too. They had a routine, and as much as they like anything, it is short-lived and they get bored. The whole point of the fight was to have all the soldiers watch Safe the Snake lose. Then, suddenly, just as some of the fighters were beginning to wander off, the mechanic suddenly went at him again, full bore. Safe didn't try to defend himself this time. He simply absorbed the blows, recalls Shark. There was no knockout punch. He just fell over. Legs out, arms up, like he raised his hand to ask a question. The referees ended the fight. Safe the Snake lost his stature and therefore his power. No need for war. Shark rotated onto another CIA base where he trained another 100 Afghan soldiers and led killer capture missions in dark places that felt evil too. A few fighting seasons later, he was back at Gecko Base in Kandahar. I figure it was 2 weeks after I returned that we were called into our oversized coliseum of a meeting room. It was an all-hands meeting, he says. The room was quiet. There were no terps, interpreters, allowed. It was only us. I wanted someone to tell a joke, to get rid of this quiet, at least talk normally, something. Then the boss, chief of base, put out that Saif Mohammed was found guilty. The story was explained. A wide variety of explosives and bullets had gone missing from the arsenal at Gecko Base, then discovered with Saif and an accomplice. Officials got involved. Saif was sent to the National Directorate of Security. He talked in prison and led investigators to his alleged accomplice, an Afghan supply officer employed by the CIA at Gecko Base. NDS located information about a plan to attack the Ground Branch team on base. It was written out in the accomplice's workbook, including sketches and maps. The plan was to steal a Ground Branch truck, fill it with 2,000 pounds of explosives, then drive it into the area near the Connex boxes and the fire pit, where the team guys made satellite phone calls home to their kids. For reasons no one could explain, but everyone understood, Saif Mohammed had been released from the NDS and had simply vanished, at least for now. After several months fighting in Kandahar, Shark rotated out again. He was transferred to yet another CIA base, where he trained another 100 Afghan Indij and went out on what by now amounted to hundreds of missions with them. In 2011, Ahmed Wali Karzai, the president's brother, was assassinated in his home by his closest confidant, a man named Sardar Mohammed. In the ensuing investigation, more information about the Afghan Indij fighters at Gecko Base surfaced. The unit was called the Kandahar Strike Force, the papers said, and described the fighters as Karzai's personal paramilitary force. These were highly trained and elite troops who underwent regular physical training, including jogging and calisthenics, target practice, and classwork, such as lectures on choosing targets for kill-and-capture raids. Why did Sardar Muhammad kill Ahmed Wali Karzai? Rumors flew. Speculative blame was divided. One theory proposed was that Sardar Muhammad was a CIA assassin. Another claimed he was a double agent for the Taliban. A third supposition speaks to life in the moral twilight zone that ground branch operators are asked to live in. In A Kingdom of Their Own, The Family Karzai and the Afghan Disaster, Josh Partlow, a Washington Post reporter in Afghanistan, described what he learned from senior U.S. military officials about the assassination. Sardar Muhammad was a pedophile, and his pedophilia had gotten way out of hand and had become an embarrassment, Partlow wrote. A group of fathers whose sons Sardar Muhammad had kidnapped, chained to his bed, and held as captives for raping had gone to AWK and said, "You've got to rein this guy in. He's out of control." AWK decided he was going to fire Sardar Muhammad from his security job and give him some other job. He summoned him over there that day to do it, and Sardar Muhammad got wind of it. He shot Ahmed Wali Karzai in the head and chest, killing him instantly. 9 years after the mission in Sangin with the upside-down truck, 500 miles to the northeast in Jalalabad, Brian Ray Hoke and a ground branch operator named Nathaniel Delamare were shot and killed by the Islamic State during a kill-or-capture mission. It was October 2011. The potential negative effects of HVT operations warned about in the leaked CIA directive, high-value targeting operations, had come true. The lethal direct action missions conducted against HVTs had resulted in precisely what the directive had forewarned, creating a vacuum into which more radical groups can enter and escalating a conflict in ways that favor the insurgents. The CIA has not released any further information about the circumstances of either man's death. In Afghanistan, the violence continued to escalate. With the 2009 inauguration of Barack Obama, there was the widely held expectation that this new president would bring peace to the troubled Middle East, that diplomacy would predominate, and the two wars America was fighting would end. Nominations for the Nobel Peace Prize occurred just 11 days after Obama took office, and his inclusion on that list was a preemptive move by the Nobel Committee. "We are hoping this may contribute a little bit for what he is trying to do," said its chairman, Thorbjørn Jagland. "The prize is a clear signal to the world. We have to get the world on the right track again." Publicly, there was hope. Privately, there was the reality of tertia optio. In his first 3 days as president, Barack Obama took action on two of the CIA programs he'd inherited from the Bush White House. After reviewing the Enhanced Interrogation Program, also called the Torture Program, he signed Executive Order 13491, revoking it. He ordered the CIA to shut down its detention and interrogation facilities, also called black sites, and prohibited the agency from opening new ones. After reviewing the lethal direct action programs, including the drone strike and ground branch programs, President Obama ordered these operations to be accelerated. His decision to shut down the enhanced interrogation program was made public, but his decision to accelerate lethal direct action missions was kept hidden. On Obama's second day in office, a ground branch team conducted a kill or capture mission in Khyber Agency, Pakistan. The target was a Saudi al-Qaeda operative named Zabu ul Taifi, involved in a series of terrorist bombings in London on July 7, 2005. The kill or capture operation was run jointly with indigenous forces, but one of the men involved told Pakistan's The News that the mission had been led by the CIA. The Americans seemed quite excited after capturing the Saudi national and immediately bundled him into their vehicle, the Pakistani soldier said. That same second day in office, President Obama also authorized two drone strikes in Pakistan, killing one al-Qaeda high-value target and up to two dozen other people. Critics accused the president of solving the torture program problem with a killing program solution. That fall, on October 9, 2009, the Nobel Committee announced that President Barack Obama had won the Nobel Peace Prize. In December, he traveled to Oslo, Norway, to receive the award. In a speech entitled, "A Just and Lasting Peace," President Obama talked mostly about war, evoking the concept of just war theory, a set of ethical principles based in Christian theology and first written about in AD 400. In the 1600 years since, just war theory has been providing leaders with the framework in which to rationalize war by reconciling three juxtaposing ideas. Taking human life is seriously wrong. A nation has a duty to defend itself and its citizens. Defending moral values can require the use of violence. Morality and warfare have been entwined across history, always with the strongest opinions reserved for assassination. Is assassination that is carried out in the name of defending the country or the moral values of the country virtuous or corrupt? In his acceptance speech, President Obama defended the war in Afghanistan as a just war, a war of last resort, of self-defense, of proportional force. He said that the goal was to spare civilians from violence. "I understand why war is not popular," he acknowledged, "but peace entails sacrifice." Without mentioning covert action, he reminded those familiar with the construct why it even exists in the first place, to prevent World War III. "Yes, terrible wars have been fought and atrocities committed," he said, "but there has been no Third World War." The Nobel Committee in Norway applauded the speech sparingly. The audience gave President Obama a standing ovation at the end. The president skipped the honorary lunch and a concert. He attended the honorary dinner and went home.